on an ongoing basis. Now, we have some new members that joined, but none of them are here, so none of them will be introduced. So we'll wait till their next lunch when hopefully they'll turn up and enjoy one of our lunches. I'd like to have a look at the on each table. We've got a list of all our supporters. You'll all know that this is the best value lunch you can buy in London ever. At the prices you're paying for the food, the company, the wine and the speeches you get. But so therefore, without the supporters, it'd be quite hard to do these lunches. So great thanks to all the supporters. Some have been doing it for quite a few years and we hope they'll continue. But without them, it'd be hard to put on a lunch like this. This is, as I say, the last lunch of the year. We'll be gathering again at the end of January at Philip's conference in Dublin, which he very kindly helps us put on, and which is very kindly also supported by the Bank of China. Every member will get an invite to the dinner. We probably won't be able to accommodate all members, but any of you going to the Airline Economics Conference in Dublin in the middle of January, it's a bit earlier this year because of the Chinese New Year, get your name down quick. And we've got Conor McCarthy, who's a very well-known Irish aviation entrepreneur who started Emerald Airlines and was also involved in AirAsia, so that'll be a good evening. In February, we have the SAS CEO. Who would ever have thought that a big national airline like SAS would be private equity owned? So that could be quite interesting to hear Anko van der Werf. And in April, we have the Finnair CEO, Turkka Kuusisto. And we've got some other good speakers later next year as well. Anyway, that brings us on to what you've all come here for. I'd like to introduce Campbell Wilson, who's the CEO of Air India. He joined Air India in June 2022 after a long and distinguished career in Singapore with Singapore Airlines, and was the number one employee at Scoot, we've just learned. You can ask him questions afterwards. Anything to do with the India-New Zealand series, he'll be very pleased to answer questions on. Anything to do with catching cricket balls, he would rather not have questions on. I'd like to introduce Campbell to you.
Thank you very much, Tony, and good afternoon, everyone. It's wonderful to see you. Namaste, and thank you for having me here to speak at this special Aviation Club lunch, and thank you very much for extending the invitation to Air India. It's indeed timely for the Indian aviation market to acclaim a little bit more attention on the world stage. For as the world's most populous economy continues to deliver on its forecast 6% annual GDP growth, as India plays a greater role in de-risking the global supply chain, and as India's propensity to travel tracks the course of earlier emerging markets, India's impact on global aviation stands to be enormous. The Indian domestic aviation market, already the third largest in the world, is growing at 7% per annum and is expected to keep doing so until 2041, by which time it would have grown threefold. The international market, which hitherto has been grossly underserved by Indian players, is currently growing even faster. This growth and opportunity have many drivers, but in the aviation governance space, three stand out. The first is a shift in government mindset from seeing aviation as a preserve of the rich and therefore something to be taxed as a luxury, to it being recognized as a catalyst of economic, social, and regional growth. The second driver is the philosophy of expanding access to air travel to more people through the development of new airport infrastructure, the support of air services into underserved regions, and the development of a low-cost airline ecosystem. The third driver is the attraction of private capital and expertise, notably through the sale of airport operating concessions, and not least the privatization of Air India back to Tata Sons, from which it had been nationalized some 60 years earlier. And the upshot of all of this has been transformation. The two largest aircraft orders in history were made by Indian Airlines last year. The national order book now sits at over 1,800 aircraft, with more to come. And the number of commercial airports in India has doubled from 74 to 149 in just 10 years, with a further 80 airports expected by 2030. In the top metro cities alone, there's new greenfield airports opening in Delhi and in Mumbai, and new terminals have opened in a number of cities, including Bangalore and Chennai. In each case, whether it be new terminals or greenfield airports, they have become operational within 4 years of breaking ground. And unlike the past, India, its airlines, its airports and governments is well aware that it has the same geographic opportunity as the Gulf Super Connectors to carry people through, not just to. India's major aviation hubs and the benefits they bring should no longer reside outside India, and there is a concerted effort to bring them back onshore. The centre of mass of global aviation is driven by economics, by technology, demographics, geography, and politics, and it doesn't stay still. And right now, that centre of gravity is moving towards India. But this story is more about the rise of Indian aviation and its coming of age. It's the story of the homecoming and the rebirth of an aviation icon, the 92-year-old Air India. For 1932, India's first commercial aviator, Mr. J.I.D. Tata, piloted the first flight of the airline that would become Air India. And under his leadership, the ensuing years saw Air India network, its reputation, its influence spread far and wide. And with an onboard product second to none, it had the finest cuisine from around the world and was a champion of culture from local artisans to international renown such as Salvador Dali. Impeccable service with an Indian touch, catering to a truly international clientele, Air India was once known as one of the world's very best airlines. Unfortunately, as we all know, more recent decades weren't so kind. Nationalisation and other decisions caused distraction and sclerosis at a time where internationally much of the world was deregulating. Protectionism and isolation resulted in a disconnect from what good looked like. And in later years, as the airline's finances became increasingly stressed, investment in equipment, product, systems, people and processes became obviously more difficult, with inevitable consequences. Even once it was recognised that the state was not the right home for Air India, divestment was not easy. Only after multiple attempts could Air India finally come back to Tata Sons in late January 2022, and just in time for The Economist to call it the Everest of corporate turnarounds. It had dilapidated facilities, mostly poorly maintained, and some, like the cabin crew training base in Mumbai, even infested with snakes. There were grossly outdated systems and processes. Air India was the last airline in the world on a particular reservation system. It was the last company in the world on a particular SAP system. In the absence of reliable company email, most official business was conducted by over 1,000 private, uncontrolled Gmail accounts. Revenue management was largely done on paper. One third of the fleet was grounded, being cannibalised for parts that the airline couldn't afford to buy so that other aircraft could fly on just a little longer. There were no job descriptions or performance management, so advancement was as much a function of tenure as it was talent. There had been no recruitment of non-flying staff since 1999, leading to an average age of 54 against a compulsory retirement age of 58. And where the youngest IT staff had joined long before the iPhone was even invented. So I could go on, but you get the picture. It was, not to put a too fine a point on it, an airline in an effectively terminal state of decline. But we also found many good people. People who had kept this airline going despite the most severe of challenges. People who were proud of Air India still and were hungry to actually help turn it around. And people who, when faced with the biggest turmoil and transformation of their entire working career, have taken the fear and the opportunity of privatisation positively, constructively, and been incredibly adaptable. So the first year following privatisation was really one of triage, stabilising what was a sinking ship. And then it was about acquiring the people, capabilities, and systems necessary to form a foundation that could safely and smoothly undertake dramatic growth. And it was during this period that we made what was the largest single aircraft order ever at that time by any airline of 470 new aircraft, plus a sizable number of leases and a few hundred additional options. These aircraft are now arriving at pace, with more than 100 new aircraft having been added to the fleet over the last 2 years, at a rate of about one every 6 days. But we're really only scratching the surface of the Indian opportunity. At the point of India's privatisation, the nation only had 43 wide-body aircraft. For context, Singapore has 150, the UAE more than 250. There is massive scope to connect India to all corners of the globe, connect the 30 million strong diaspora with home, and connect the globe across India. From an operating fleet of around 90 at the point of privatisation, through organic growth and acquisition, the Air India Group now has a fleet of 300 and is on pace to approach 400 by 2027. Even then, Air India's potential for further growth will remain enormous. The team transforming the new Air India has undergone similarly dramatic change. The average age has dropped from 54 to 35, and amongst our cabin crew cohort to just 28. The entire leadership team has been refreshed. Over 3,000 people have amicably departed the business, and more than 9,000 new staff have been recruited to bring contemporary skills and industry expertise. A company that was once spread across 63 different offices has been consolidated into one new, brand new headquarter campus, while South Asia's largest training academy has been set up to train and upskill more than 2,000 people each day. Last week saw the completion of an annex that will soon house the first of more than 20 flight simulators, and next year we'll see a 34 aircraft cadet pilot school open. In parallel, we've also broken ground on a 12 hangar maintenance base that will be operational in 2026. More than 140 IT systems have been cut over or massively upgraded, including every single core system, reservations and departure control, maintenance planning, crew rostering, SAP, ERP, HR systems, revenue accounting, revenue management, crew management, disruption management, compliance management, safety management, loyalty management, to name just a few. From being an absolute laggard, Air India's digital systems are now close to being the global airline benchmark, and our teams are now challenged to use them to the best of their capability. So suffice it to say that no stone is being left unturned in putting in place the necessary infrastructure and capabilities needed for Air India to retain its former glory. And just to add some extra challenge, whilst doing all this, we have started and in fact completed not one but two airline mergers concurrently. For in addition to acquiring the full-service Air India, privatisation also brought the low-cost Air India Express into the Tata Group, joining two other joint venture airlines, the full-service Vistara, which was operated in conjunction with Singapore Airlines, and Air Asia India, which was operated together with Malaysia's Air Asia Group. So in parallel with Air India's restoration, resuscitation, expansion and transformation, we've merged four airlines into a group operating a single full-service airline and a single low-cost airline. We've aligned five sets of pilots, four sets of cabin crew, and four sets of non-flying employees into single contracts, single seniority, terms and conditions. Nearly 30,000 staff have been fitted and evaluated into a new organisation structure, and who now share a common physical premises. All IT systems, 300 aircraft, and over 4,000 supplier contracts have been aligned, along with 10,000 pages of regulatory manuals. Thousands of crew and other professionals have been trained on the new ways of operating. A quarter of a million customer bookings have been transferred, and more than 4.5 million frequent flyer records merged into the Air India program. Again, the list goes on, but despite the hangovers of COVID, the immature environment, and the absence of an Indian regulatory precedent, what has taken international peers the best part of 8 long years to complete has been achieved in barely 2. For all that has happened behind the scenes, though, it's natural and proper that we are judged really on what the customer experience is. And for an airline, that is very much what people see at the airport and what they find on the aircraft. And on those fronts, we still have a bit to go. Even at the rate of delivery of one aircraft every 6 days, renewing a fleet takes time, and there remains a large legacy fleet to upgrade. Pleasingly, the refit of our narrow-body aircraft is progressing well and should be complete by the middle of 2025. But the wide bodies have been a constant source of frustration. Back in 2022, we committed $400 million. We selected the seats. We started the process of design and certification. But supply chain constraints have just been a constant headwind. Finally, the first of the wide body aircraft will go into the hangar for refit in February. In the meantime, thanks to leased aircraft, the first of India's A350 aircraft and the aircraft we acquired when we took Vistara, about one third of our wide-body fleet has now been modernized. And as the legacy aircraft refit of wide-body aircraft rolls out, we should get the rest of the fleet reborn effectively by end of 2026, sometime early 2027. So together with that flagship A350, which amongst other routes now operates twice daily between Heathrow and Delhi, our in-flight service proposition has been completely redesigned. All of our legacy cabin crew have undergone rigorous training to our new standards, accompanying 5,000 new cabin crew. We've completely revamped our frequent flyer program, opened Air India's first flagship lounge in Bangalore, and are well underway of constructing a new lounge in Delhi. And the results I've described are now starting to bear fruit where it matters most. Customer NPS on our A350s is 100 percentage points higher than it was on the legacy wide-body aircraft. And across all aircraft, all fleet, it's gone up 40 points in the last 12 months. Operational reliability with older aircraft has been a challenge, but as we get those aircraft healthy and get access to components and parts, that's also improving. And the economic performance is heading in the right direction. Load factors, yields, cargo revenues, gross margins, all dramatically higher. And for an airline that had been chronically loss-making for decades, we are now EBITDA positive. And with the airline mergers now fully complete, we can really now focus our attention on consistency, on improvement, on profitability, and bringing Air India back to where we aspire it to be. One can argue that right now in aviation, there is really no location on earth more exciting and more interested to be than India. The economic, demographic, geographic winds are at our back. India's natural warmth and hospitality, its technical capabilities and innovation, supported by new capital and ambition, can underpin Indian airlines that can match or surpass of anything others can offer. And so realizing India's aviation opportunity by the centenary of JRD Tata's first flight, which is now only 8 years away, would in our view be the finest possible tribute to his pioneering achievements and his legacy. And so for that reason, my colleagues and I really feel that we're on a national mission. A national mission to make the new Air India an airline that represents India to the world in the way that India deserves to be represented. To make Air India an airline that every Indian and friend of India is proud of. And by no means least, to live up to the expectations of JRD Tata himself when he said that this airline, Air India, must never, ever be allowed to be anything but the best. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that gave you a flavour of what we've been up to over the last couple of years since Air India was privatised. I hope it gives you a sense of why we have committed so much money for so many aircraft and why we remain so optimistic about the return on that money. Don't know whether you have any questions, but I'm happy to answer any.
Got to come to the microphone. Quite a busy 2 years you've had. First, the journalist, the straight in here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tony. Campbell, nice to see you again. Great story, of course. On the super connectors of the competition with the Gulf carriers, how do you feel you're doing in terms of your product and sort of winning some of that traffic back that they've been siphoning off very successfully for years? That's sort of the first part. The second part is the political environment in India to the bilaterals to opening up the traffic rights. You know, how do you see that developing? From your side, what would you like to see, perhaps?
Well, I think you can answer that second part yourself. What I'd like to see, but aviation bilaterals are a complex thing. You know, agreements between governments, other economic opportunities besides aviation, the desires of the respective populace, and so. But from our perspective, we look at the fact that, you know, India's major aviation hub is not actually in India. 90% of what some of the Gulf carriers take out of India doesn't even stop at their hub. You know, it transits and continues on. And so that siphoning of traffic has been one of the reasons why Indian aviation has not been able to grow and realize its full potential, because the traffic is leaking elsewhere. Of course, a lot of it was in our own hands. There wasn't the capital and the capacity being put in place. There wasn't the product quality to entice the customer to fly on what was there. And so as we acquire these aircraft, 470 and counting, as we improve the customer proposition and the loyalty programs and everything else such that people are now keen to fly us, I think people will come back to flying nonstop, because clearly it's a much better proposition to fly nonstop from India to wherever you wish to go rather than have to stop off at 3 o'clock in the morning and schlep through an airport for a couple of hours. So look, it's work in progress, it will take some time. I think there's always going to be competition, and it's a good thing. But the type of traffic that we carry, as much as the volume of traffic we carry, will evolve as the airline itself evolves.
Thanks, Campbell. Simple question. No one denies the growth opportunity India has, and Air India has. What do you think are the biggest challenges you face within your control and outside your control, and how are you going to overcome those?
Biggest challenge we face in our... There's many challenges. One of the things that I used to describe this job when I took over is that it's like walking down a beach and there's 10,000 stones, and under each stone there's some sort of creepy crawly. And you get to work on Monday, and which four stones am I going to pick up this week? So there's always going to be surprises and challenges. I think when you have a large wide-body network and want to build a large wide-body hub, you're going to have a significant belly-hold cargo business. And at the moment, the infrastructure in Indian airports is not quite up to where it should be. And the regulatory environment is a little bit constraining. You've got to break down cargo before you can reload it on another aircraft for transshipment. And so that could be an impediment. Likewise, visa regimes and the customer experience that people undergo when entering or exiting India. There's been significant advancement in that. I can go through Delhi Airport as a domestic passenger now without even having to show any IDs. My face is my ID the whole way through the system from curbside to aircraft. But that needs to be fleshed out and become a more consistent proposition for international travelers as well. Inside, it's about consistency. We've put a lot of things together, a lot of people together, a lot of systems together, but at the moment, it's not a consistent experience, either operationally or for a customer. You can fly on a brand new A350 on one flight, and you can fly on a 15-year-old 777 that hasn't been upgraded in that long on another. And so as we go through that process of rehabilitating the aircraft over the next 2 years, at least the consistency of customer experience, the consistency of operations and process will be fixed.
Richard Stokes, a technology question. By the way, I was the guy that sold the oldest PSS system to Air India 15 years ago, so thanks for mentioning it. India is a great home for technology and also for technologists, and yet most Indian aviation uses outside technology. In your reservation system, queue system, whatever else, do you see that changing and perhaps bringing it back home?
Yeah, well, who knows what the future holds? I think for the early phase, there was just so much to do. You're better to take something tried and true off the shelf and develop around that. When I say that we have a very modern infrastructure, it's because we're able to take the latest generation of systems that are much more easily interconnected, that allow a lot more modularity and interchangeability. We've used a lot of resource from TCS, which is also a Tata company, and other digital companies within the Tata fold. And we have been able to build already quite a bit ourselves. I mean, if you go to our website and use our Gen AI chatbot, that was the first in the industry and deals with, I think, 30,000 queries a day successfully with a 98% success rate. So increasingly we will develop our own, but it's not our core competency yet. We've got many other demands on our time and resources, and so for now let's take the path of lesser resistance.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. But more of a bit of a leadership question. Over the years, expats have been hired the world over to get flag carriers back into, onto even keel and into shape, some with more, some with less success. Arguably, it's been a successful run so far. What do you attribute that to be able to implement your mandate with such, great results that you've had so far? What are you thankful for? What do you rely on day to day?
I'll answer that in two parts. I'll leave the expat one separately. Look, you've got to have an aligned board and shareholder. You've got to have access to capital. in our case, you've also got to have people aligning behind a common direction and a common mission. And I alluded to the remarks, but Air India hadn't recruited since 1999 non-flight staff, which meant you had a huge hole in the business. And one of the benefits of that, there are many downsides, one of the benefits, is that you could inject people into the business very quickly without anyone feeling threatened or having to be expelled. At the same time, you had an average age of 54 with a compulsory retirement age of 58, and a lot of people were being scared about the transition to private enterprise would be. So by giving people a voluntary exit, incentivized exit, 3,000 people took it, which allowed you to do a complete talent and culture and mindset refresh almost at once. And then, of course, you're selling the national story, you carry the national name. You're resuscitating something that was also founded by J.R.D. Tata. People are hungry for Air India's success and they want to be part of that. So if you paint all the picture together and then give people the career opportunity that comes with 470 new aircraft and the promotion and command pathway that brings, very quickly people, you know, they're not focusing on today and the other, they're focusing on tomorrow and the future. So that's probably been a number of the sort of environmental and stakeholder elements that we've had to bring together in support of this, and I think that's what has allowed it to proceed as smoothly as it did, particularly bringing five groups of pilots together. I say five because Indian Airline pilots, although the airline supposedly merged with Air India in 2007, it was never consummated. So we had to get five pilots into a single seniority. As far as, look, this is a multinational team, it's almost 99.5% of Indian team, but it comes from many different parts of the Tata ecosystem as well as outside. And because it is this national turnaround, because it is this Everest of corporate turnarounds, the Economist corporate, I think everyone is just focused on that mission and that success regardless of your background, regardless of where you're from. If you're contributing to the task and contributing well, it's material.
Thank you for the presentation. It's impossible not to associate India with historically with graft and corruption, and I'm quite sure that that has not gone away. How do you engage in disentangling the new private enterprise from that foundation of pretty extensive graft and corruption in India as a state?
Well, I think if you know anything about Tata, you know, they are renowned as the most steadfast and stand-up Indian. So that's just part of the DNA of Tata and every Tata enterprise. And we're very strict on the values and way of operating that any employee and any supplier has to subscribe to. The government sold Air India for a reason. That's probably one of the single greatest surprises that I have had is the degree to which the government has said, this is now a private business, you run it in a private way, we're not going to influence or dictate, you know, go ahead and make it successful. Then, of course, a lot of malfeasance happens when there's a human in the middle. And so a lot of the IT system and integration that we've done is to take the human out of it. And so you cannot corrupt data. Things aren't visible. There's no hiding from the truth. And then, that, of course, the lesser opportunity, people trust the system a little more, so therefore they don't take any license to cause mischief themselves. There's no magic bullet, it's just a combination of